at englishradio@irrb.ir. You can also visit our website at parstoday.com. Alternatively, you can also find us on the various social media accounts we have, on, for example, Facebook or Instagram, under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
On October 7th, the U.S. Navy announced that 5 days earlier, on October 2nd, its Sea Wolf-class nuclear-powered and nuclear weapons-capable submarine, USS Connecticut, had hit an unidentified object in the South China Sea. The U.S. Navy's announcement was brief and vague. It did not say what the submarine hit or where, only that it was operating in international waters in the Indo-Pacific region. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you, written by Mark J. Valencia, an internationally recognized maritime policy analyst, political commentator, and consultant focused on Asia, titled U.S. Nuclear Subaccident Warns of Potential for Catastrophe. The article was published by the Asia Times Daily. Please stay tuned. The recent U.S. nuclear sub-accident demonstrated operator incompetence, government hypocrisy, and the environment threat posed by such operations in the South China Sea. On October 7th, the U.S. Navy announced that, 5 days earlier on October 2nd, its Sea Wolf-class nuclear-powered and nuclear weapons-capable submarine USS Connecticut had hit an unidentified object in the South China Sea. According to the announcement, the submarine remained in a safe and stable condition and its nuclear propulsion plant and spaces were not affected and remained fully operational. The vessel eventually proceeded on the surface under its own power of Guam. There, the damage is being assessed. The U.S. Navy's announcement was brief and vague. It did not say what the submarine hit or where, only that it was operating in international waters in the Indo-Pacific region. It turned out to be a seamount in the South China Sea. The incompetence of the SOP commanders was admitted. In removing two officers and the chief of the boat from their positions, Vice Admiral Carl Thomas, commander of the U.S. 7th Fleet, detailed their errors. He determined that sound judgment, prudent decision-making, and adherence to required procedures in navigation planning, watch team execution, and risk management could have prevented the incident. As a former U.S. attack sub-commander put it, not everything goes right all the time, and even pros have had bad days. In this case, they had a very bad day. U.S. hypocrisy was painfully apparent. The U.S. has frequently accused China of a lack of transparency in military matters. This is a red herring. Military transparency favors the stronger players because they can learn the weaknesses of others while intimidating them by allowing calculated glimpses of their superiority. In this instance, the U.S. was anything but transparent regarding the details, even though the accident generated worries about radiation affecting its friends and allies in the region. China's foreign ministry spokesperson said the United States should clarify more details of the occurrence, including the specific location, the intention of its navigation, what kind of object the SOP had struck, whether it caused a nuclear leak that would contaminate the marine environment. It's responsible and displays a lack of transparency on the part of the U.S. to deliberately delay and conceal the details of the accident. The U.S. Navy said the delay in reporting the incident was due to concerns about keeping the damaged sub safe and ensuring a thorough investigation of the incident. The Navy refused to specify the location of the accident due to operation security. But it is not clear why reporting the incident right away and its location would endanger the sub's safety and compromise the investigation. One possibility is that the accident occurred in waters under China's jurisdiction and the U.S. feared that China might demand to take over or at least participate in the investigation. In other words, the SOP may have been violating China's laws and rights in its 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zone, that is EEZ. On October 3rd, the day after the accident, a Sea Wolf SOP was spotted on the surface 43 miles southeast of the Paracel Islands, so the accident might well have occurred within China's 200 nm EEZ around the Paracels. According to the SOP manufacturer General Dynamics Electric Boat, the mission of the Sea Wolf class of submarines include surveillance, intelligence collection, and special warfare, especially in shallow waters. China has military installations on the Paracels. It also has a very sensitive naval base at the Yanlin on Hainan, where it bases its nuclear-powered and nuclear-capable submarines. These circumstances again raise questions of what the Connecticut was doing and where. Adding to the worries, a month after the incident, the U.S. deployed a radiation-sniffing aircraft, a Boeing WC-135, over the South China Sea, a relatively rare occurrence. The primary mission of such an aircraft is to collect atmospheric samples to detect nuclear radiation. But if there was no leakage of radiation from the SOP, what prompted the mission? It would be in the region's public interest for the U.S. to disclose what it found. The incident also raised the possibility of a catastrophic incident involving a nuclear-powered or nuclear-armed vessel that releases radiation into the environment. This is not hyperbole. Globally, 9 nuclear submarines have sunk. The Soviet Navy lost five, one of which sank twice. The Russian Navy too and the U.S. Navy too. These were worst-case scenarios, but non-catastrophic accidents, once rare, are becoming more frequent as the numbers of such vessels increase. In 2003, the Los Angeles-class USS Hartford grounded entering a port in Sardinia. In January 2005, the Los Angeles-class USS San Francisco struck a seamount near the Caroline Islands that did not appear on the charts the crew was using to navigate without active sonar. The sub sustained severe damage to its forward ballast tanks and sonar dome, and the vessel was almost lost. Again in March 2009, the Hartford collided with a U.S. amphibious dock in the Strait of Hormuz. In November 2015, an Ohio-class sub grounded as it was entering its port of King Bay, Georgia. This is what the public knows, but there may have been many more near misses. The worst U.S. nuclear submarine disasters were the April 1963 loss of the Thresher and the May 1968 loss of the Scorpion. Both sank in the North Atlantic with all hands as well as their nuclear reactors and torpedoes. As more nuclear subs are built and deployed, the chance of a catastrophic accident increases. Including in the South China Sea, the U.S. deployed nuclear subs at least 11 times last year. Other countries also operate nuclear submarines in the South China Sea, including France and perhaps the U.K. as part of its Queen Elizabeth Aircraft Carrier Strike Group. India, which is now sending warships to the South China Sea, has only one nuclear-powered sub, but is building more. China already has four Jin-class nuclear submarines and is hoping to acquire another four by 2030. The AUKUS agreement for the U.S. and the U.K. to supply nuclear submarine technology to Australia for operations that include the South China Sea will add to the mix. Operating submarines is difficult and dangerous. Most subs have both active and passive sonar. Active sonar sends out acoustic pulses or pings. The ping will reflect back if it hits an object like a whale, a ship, a seamount, or another submarine. But subs operating in stealth mode turn off their active sonar because the ping could give away their location. The South China Sea is a difficult operating environment for submarines. It is particularly noisy and has rather complex and shifting bottom topography. Much of it is shallower than 200 meters, especially the approaches to the China coast. This means subs have to operate in a narrow zone between a safe distance from the bottom, but deep enough to avoid detection. An accident that released significant radiation into the marine environment would be a nightmare for the regional countries. Southeast Asians rely more heavily on fish as a primary source of dietary protein and income generation than any other people in the world. Such an accident could damage the marine food supply for all littoral countries. It would probably create an aversion to eating seafood even if it were safe. Judging from Fukushima disaster in Japan, although the radiation may be insignificant or rapidly decreased to safe levels, the reputational damage to the fishery would last much longer. The South China Sea coastal countries have legitimate cause for concern. If the countries with nuclear subs continue this risky behavior in other countries' EEZs, they may be violating the duty mandated by the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea to pay due regard to the rights and duties of coastal states, such as protecting the environment and not presenting a hazard to shipping. Risky behavior that endangers others requires a robust response. It may even be eventually necessary for countries to establish the equivalent of sea defense identification zones, SEADIZ, for submarines. Like air defense identification zones, their function would be to serve as early warning areas. In such zones, submarines, manned or unmanned, would be requested to identify themselves, their destination and mission. If they did not, then they would be treated as potentially hostile and closely tracked wherever they went. Such a drastic step could be obviated by more responsible and transparent operations of nuclear submarines. However, as the Connecticut accident and its aftermath show, this is highly unlikely.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at Amir al-Mu'mineen's vision when it comes to practicing social justice among the Muslims of his time or the people of his time. And we can see that very clear in the words and the actions of Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullahi alayhi. One of the first things that the Imam alayhi salam did, and his approach when he went to Iraq to be the governor or the Khalifa, is that he rejected the division based on race or ethnicity. That was something that was rejected by Amir al-Mu'mineen. And even the nationalist throughout the Arabian kind of culture, where the nobles, those who have noble origin, they would prefer themselves over others. He did that, made no difference to him at all. He says, "Man abta'a bihi 'amaluhu lam yusra' bihi nasabuh." When it comes to your actions, if you don't do any good actions, your lineage, your origin, whether you're a noble family or not, will not do you any good. So one should not be seeking anything from Amir al-Mu'mineen based on his nobility or origin, and trying to have this division. So he tried to eliminate and eradicate this kind of notion between people that they are from a noble family and these guys are not. And then he says, وَالْدَلِيلُ عَنْدِي عَزِيزٍ. Those who are oppressed, those who are being humiliated in society, to me they are honored. In my presence they are honored. حَتَّى أَأَخُذَ الْحَقَّ لَهُ. Until I take their rights for them. Because they are of, a less noble family or not known people, and people look down at them, he says, I will take their rights for them. To me, they are honored because they are, at the end of the day, human beings, mu'mineen. So I will take their rights. And he says, وَالْقَوِيُّ عَنْدِي ضَعِيفٌ. And those who are in power, those who think they are I don't know, strong and have, you know, things to fight with and things to bring forward. I'm of this family. I am of this race. You know, I'm an Arab. I'm from Quraysh. He's like, this kind of strength that you have, to me, it is nothing. He says, والقوي عندي ضعيف. Those who think they are strong, in my sight, to me, they are weak. حتى أخذ الحق منه. Until I take right, or take the right from them. So you see clearly, Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, he's saying, I will stand with the truth. I will stand with justice. I will stand with fairness and equality. And I will not make any differences between people based on their race or authenticity. To him, it meant absolutely nothing. And then he made it clear and he says, أطهر الناس أعراق أحسنهم أخلاقا. When it comes to the purest people, when it comes to races, the purest form of race is ethics. If you have good ethics, if you got good morals, then you are the best of people. And then he says, وأفضل الناس أنفعهم للناس. And the best amongst people is the one who is more beneficial to people. Those are the ones he respected. Those are the ones who thought they were doing the right thing. Not because of your lineage, not because of your family name, not because of your title. To Amir al-Mu'mineen, it meant absolutely nothing. And he says, I will take the right from those who think they are powerful, and I will give it to those who are weak. Let's continue after a short break, inshallah.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Now, so the concept of fairness and equality in the sight of Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, it rejects race and authenticity from whatever aspect it is, positive or negative. It's completely rejected in his sight. But he used to make it as a way to connect people, as a way to bring people together, not divide them. So he says, As-sabiqu khamsa, those who came first are five. Fa'ana sabiqu al-Arab, for I am the first of the Arabs to be a believer in the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. Was-Salman sabiqu al-Furs, and Salman is the first amongst or from the Persian. Was-Suhayb سابق الروم, and from the Romans we have Suhaib. وبلال سابق الحبشة, and Bilal is the first from Abyssinia. وخباط سابق النبط, and Khabbat is the first that comes from Nabt, which is in Syria. So he says, these people, me, Salman, Suhaib al-Rumi, Bilal, we were from different ethnicities, different cultures, different races. Yet, we came all together under one banner, and we treat each other similarly, and we treat each other fairly, and we treat each other with fairness. So, if you guys want to have any of this notion between you that, oh, I'm better than him, I am white and he's black, or I don't know, I'm Arab, he's Persian, he said that made no difference between us. Because both Persians, Arabs, Romans, Abyssinia, and Sham, they all came together. They were all the same. They were treated the same. For example, they didn't look at Bilal and said, well, he's black, for example, from Abyssinia. We and blacks are slaves, therefore we will not, you know, we will look at him different. Or, for example, Salman, because he's a Persian, therefore we're going to treat him differently. Or Suhaib, because he was a Roman, therefore we treat him differently. Absolutely the contrary. Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi and the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he treated them with fairness and equality. In fact, it's not the Prophet, it's not Amir al-Mu'mineen. That's just the teaching of Islam. That what Islam teaches. Islam says no races, no authenticities, no nothing. You're all the same in the eyes and the sight of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Akramakum indallah atqakum, the most honored amongst you, human beings in general, is the more pious. If you are pious, the higher you are in piety, the better you are in the sight of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Not your wealth, not your lineage, not your family, not your title, nothing. And Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, and he had to deal with this concept heavily during his rule, because people were still living in the dark ages. They still have the old back pagan mentality, where it is based on tribal mentality, that my tribe is better than other tribes. And the biggest names that we have in history, those who call themselves companions of the Prophet, he had to deal with them and this backward mentality, where they were asking for a lot of things that wasn't theirs, and he had to stop against them, to the point where some of them decided to go to war with him because they could not handle and accept the justice of Amir al-Mu'mineen and the fairness and equality of Amir al-Mu'mineen. They could not handle it, so they had to wage war, and first of which was the Battle of the Camel, and then Safin, and then Nahrawan, until they had to kill Amir al-Mu'mineen in order to get in order for them to get their ways. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
Hundreds of campaigners representing indigenous communities, young people, and civil society groups recently poured into the hallways of the venue of COP, chanting, "Keep 1.5 degrees Celsius alive," and condemning political leaders for failing to deliver an agreement that will limit global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels by the end of the century. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Julia Conley, journalist. This article is titled, "Leaders at COP26 are massively killing the Paris Agreement," critics say. Stay tuned for more. Hundreds of campaigners representing indigenous communities, young people, and civil society groups recently poured into the hallways of the venue of COP26 chanting, "Keep 1.5 degrees Celsius alive," and condemning political leaders for failing to deliver an agreement that will limit global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels by the end of the century. Advocates called the demonstration a people's plenary and proceeded out into the street for a rally with members of Extinction Rebellion and Fridays for Future. "This is the real atmosphere of people fighting for their needs," Kata Rizna Neymer, a climate activist from Poland, told the Washington Post. Despite warnings from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, and climate scientists around the world that allowing the Earth's temperature to rise above the 1.5 degrees Celsius threshold will lead to irreversible damage to the environment and will prove deadly for people in frontline communities across the globe. Experts say the negotiations during the COP26 have put the planet on track for warming between 1.8 degrees Celsius and 2.5 degrees Celsius. Climate justice advocates, including the campaign group Corporate Accountability, expressed outrage at the lack of equity, urgency, and ambition by world leaders and wealthy nations. Climate action means rejecting big polluter schemes like carbon markets, paying up for loss and damage, and advancing real solutions like making polluters pay, tweeted Corporate Accountability recently. While pledging to keep 1.5 alive, said Corporate Accountability, leaders have failed to deliver on any meaningful pathway to do so. The group added, "The deal on the table is a death sentence for millions of those on the front lines." Campaigners condemned the leaders' insistence on including language that leaves the door open for techno-fixes and false solutions like carbon capture technology. "The draft decision is massively killing the Paris Agreement," said Mina Rahman of Third World Network and Friends of the Earth Malaysia. "No finance, no technology transfer, no adaptation, no loss and damage." As Common Dreams reported recently, countries in the global south not only face an existential threat from extreme weather events brought on by the climate emergency in the coming years, illustrated by Tuvalu Foreign Minister Simon Kofe, who addressed the summit standing in knee-deep water, but also are expected to lose an average of 20% of their gross domestic product in the next three decades, and 64% by 2100 if the 1.5 degrees Celsius threshold is crossed. Meanwhile, a $100 billion annual funding pledge made by wealthy countries with the aim of helping developing nations mitigate the climate crisis is now scheduled to be delivered starting in 2023, 3 years late. The draft text noted with deep regret the failure to provide the funding and called for a doubling of funds by 2025. But leaders have not reached an agreement on providing new financing to help with the damage that has already been done. The text included language calling only for a technical assistance facility to aid countries that have suffered losses and damages. The wealthiest have said that their coffers are empty, treating climate finance as if it were some loose change to be found down the back of the sofa, said Asad Rahman of War on Want. In 2021, this new text may have plenty of warm words to acknowledge and urge when what we really needed was will, and what we needed when your house is on fire. And for those trapped in that fire, not for us to acknowledge that there is a fire or that we should ring the fire brigade, but to actually act.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Tensions between Russia and the U.S. are on the rise again. On Friday, Moscow said it detected 6 NATO reconnaissance flights over the Black Sea over the span of 24 hours, reiterating its warning that it will defend itself against any threats along its borders. The Black Sea is a sensitive security zone for Moscow as it's located near the Crimean Peninsula, which was reunited with Russia from Ukraine in a referendum in 2014, a move that the West deems illegal.
2014 was a defining moment. Russia stood up for itself like it stood up in 2015 in Damascus, across Syria. And this is what's of most concern to Washington in their search for a unipolar world, that Russia would have the audacity, the courage to stand up for itself.
NATO has recently ramped up activities in the form of holding drills and deployment of warships in the strategic region, in a move expected to provoke a response from Russia along its western borders. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov described on Friday as provocative the increasing NATO's activities in the Black Sea and the presence of Western spy planes in the region.
I mean, Russia doesn't have anywhere close to the amount of U.S. military, the bases that the U.S. has surrounding Russia. Imagine if Russia had bases in Mexico and Canada and in the Pacific. The U.S. would never stand for that. So what we see on full display here is U.S. hypocrisy in the same Russophobic attitude that has characterized U.S. foreign policy for how many decades now.
The Russian Defense Ministry said on Tuesday that the United States was setting up a multinational group of armed forces close to Russia's border in the Black Sea region. The Kremlin has dismissed a Western media report that said the U.S. was concerned about a possible Russian attack on Ukraine, noting that Russia has posed no threats to any country.
And of course, the U.S. acting through NATO with its junior allies, constantly building up troops in Latvia, in Estonia, in Poland, across Russia's borders. So it's the Russians that have every right to be concerned.
In the meantime, the migrant crisis at the border between Belarus and Poland is also spiraling into another regional dispute involving the West at Russia's doorsteps. Thousands of migrants have been stranded along the border for months after being denied entry to the European Union by Poland. Minsk says Warsaw is violating international asylum norms by preventing the migrants from crossing the border and greeting them with a heavy-handed response. In face of escalating military activities near the border, Belarus and Russia held snap joint military drills in the area. Russia's defense ministry confirmed in a statement that its paratroopers were taking part in the exercise. Minsk has also threatened to cut off Russian gas supplies to Europe through pipelines that transit through Belarusian territory in retaliation for any possible sanctions from the EU. It would be bad news for Europe if Belarus moves to carry out the threat, as gas prices on the continent have already hit all-time highs and are vulnerable to any possible supply disruptions.
The United States has decided to bolster its military ties to NATO ally Greece. The military agreement was concluded during the recent visit of the Greek Minister of Foreign Affairs, Nikos Dendias, to Washington. The new agreement will remain in force indefinitely unless one of the parties withdraws. The military agreement will make Greece the U.S. military logistics center in the region.
Greece has been in America's orbit and has enjoyed a strategic partnership with America ever since the end of the Greek Civil War, in which the Greek nationalists triumphed over the Greek communists as a result of the military assistance which America provided to them.
The U.S. will also have increased military presence in the Alexandroupolis, Crete, the Tochoro, and Larissa regions. The renewed agreement gives the U.S. the right to access any Greek military bases and to expand the areas for the U.S. forces to conduct military drills. The U.S. Navy will also be able to go to Bulgaria and Romania without using Turkey's straits. The agreement will significantly reduce the importance of Turkey regarding Black Sea access. Greece has been trying to position itself strategically in the region.
The Americans are encountering some problems with Erdogan. So by America and Greece concluding this extraordinary military deal, it is a way of the Americans placing subtle pressure on Erdogan, not on the Turkish state, but on Erdogan personally.
In recent months, the U.S. has sent heavy military equipment to the Balkans and European countries through the port of Alexandroupolis, with plans for further military shipments in November. Back in November 2020, Greece submitted a request to the U.S. Department of Defense to purchase F-35 fighter jets. The proposal was welcomed by the U.S. In other words, it would not be surprising if the F-35s, which were not given to Turkey, were given to the neighboring countries soon. The military cooperation between the U.S. and Greece comes amid a row between Ankara and Athens. Greece and Turkey are both NATO members, but they are at loggerheads over a number of issues. Back in 2020, Turkey dispatched Oruç Reis and warships escorting it to survey an area between Cyprus and the Greek island of Crete in the eastern Mediterranean Sea. The mission was meant to explore oil and natural gas in that region. That led to an escalation of tensions, with the two NATO allies launching air and naval drills of their own in the waters.
The major reason behind this agreement, this military agreement between Washington and Athens, is a result of America having gathered some of its allies from the Mediterranean, North Africa, and the Middle East in an Eastern Mediterranean partnership. Now, what am I referring to? Well, I'm referring to the reserves of oil and gas which have been found adjacent to Cyprus.
Greece has also accused Turkey of acting like a pirate state in the Aegean Sea in regards to migrants. Athens has called on the EU to put pressure on Ankara to meet its international obligations. Athens frequently blames Ankara for failing to crack down on smugglers who send out migrants in unsafe boats from its shores in breach of a 2016 accord with the European Union. Under the accord, Turkey was to reduce the flow of migrants through its territory to EU countries such as Greece, return for billions in financial aid.
Well, of course, Turkey is a dangerously expansionist country. After all, Turkey illegally occupies the north of Cyprus. Turkey illegally occupies the northwest of Syria. However, there is very little chance of a conflict between Turkey and Greece. Why? Because both countries are in NATO and both countries enjoy a strategic partnership with America.
It is believed Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is using the migrant issue to put more pressure on the European Union. The military cooperation between Greece and the U.S. would give Athens a greater leverage in its confrontation with Turkey. The Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has not made it a secret in the aspirations that it has to have influence in the entire West Asia region and beyond.
World temperatures are rising fast, and that is mostly because humans are using fossil fuels like oil, gas, and coal for their transportation, industries, and homes. The use of these fuels releases a great amount of greenhouse gases, mostly carbon dioxide, which trap the sun's heat and make the earth warmer. That is global warming. This phenomenon is leading to long-term shifts in temperatures and weather patterns, which is known as climate change. The dangerous trend is causing extreme weather conditions. The impact is being felt in many parts of the world, but the worst could be yet to come. Combating climate change requires concrete measures by the international community, especially the world's largest polluters like the United States and China. But scientists have repeatedly warned that global efforts to tackle climate change are way off track. Global warming and climate change have been under the spotlight in the Scottish city of Glasgow over the past 2 weeks as delegations from around the world attended the UN Climate Change Conference. Participants tried hard to find a way forward to contain what many scientists have called the biggest crisis of humanity. The world's largest industrial nations long struggled to find common ground, but an unexpected declaration by the United States and China this week raised hopes for a breakthrough.
Certain elements that will promote ambition.
The United States and China have pledged to work together to achieve the 1.5 degrees Celsius temperature goal set out in 2015. China's climate envoys, as the two sides hammered out the declaration following some 30 meetings over the past year. U.S. President Joe Biden and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping are expected to hold a follow-up meeting soon. The announcement was welcomed by the United Nations and the European Union. But global campaigning network Greenpeace says both countries need to take concrete action. Some experts have noted that this week's declaration was short on commitments that would significantly reduce the emissions of harmful gases like CO2.
Everyone is being very careful not to say anything definitive. There are few dates, few specific levels things will get to, and few amounts of money that will go to developing countries. So there's pretty much nothing that doesn't need to be more specific. You know, we're all good guys and we're gonna cooperate and make this work. Well, we've heard that before.
Scientists warn that the world faces a race against time. Climate Action Tracker Group has calculated that the world is facing 2.4 degrees of warming by the end of the 21st century. If the world fails to act, scientists estimate that it could even exceed 4 degrees in the future. That will probably lead to destructive heat waves, with many millions of people around the world losing their homes as sea levels rise. Temperature rises must be contained quickly if the international community is determined to avoid the worst consequences of climate change. That means global warming needs to be kept at 1.5 degrees Celsius in the coming decades. That seems like a far-fetched wish, given the record of the worst polluters.
I'm not feeling overly optimistic. I'm not really feeling optimistic at all, because it seems like this is just more grandstanding by the particularly China and the United States and even the European Union, who have gotten things, the developing countries have gotten things to this point.
All eyes are now on the world's largest emitters to see how they will act.
The United States Federal Bureau of Investigation is taken to court over a lawsuit by three Muslim men that alleges the agency illegally conducted surveillance on them on the basis of their religion. Sheikh Yasir Fazaga, Ali Malik, and Yasser Abdulrahim, the three plaintiffs in the case, argue that the U.S. government has for years invoked national security to escape accountability over its unconstitutional surveillance operations and deny them the chance to present their evidence to the court. Initially filed in 2011, their case was first dismissed by a lower court in favor of the FBI's assertion that allowing it to move forward would pose a national security risk. The trio appealed the ruling, and a federal appeals court later sided with them, paving the way for the case to land in the High Court. The FBI recruited a paid informant to spy on the mosque and other places of worship in the area beginning in 2006. The informant, identified as Craig Monte, had presented himself as a person who wanted to convert to Islam.
They've always tried to label Muslims as potential terrorists and investigate them, monitor them, looking in, all their most of their privacy has been breached. All these mosques, as we can read and study about, is pretty much, it's open to the FBI to, send in informants, spies, make them feel very uncomfortable, and also a lot of them are saying that they feel like second-class citizens or third-class citizens inside their own country.
Fazaga, the lead plaintiff in the case who is also a therapist, said he was furious when he found out that the FBI informant secretly recorded the personal and confidential sessions he had with his patients for a month. The surveillance operation in Southern California was part of a broader spying program that the U.S. government enforced after 9/11, using various tactics to monitor Muslim communities in the name of national security.
This is a systematic problem in the U.S., and they wanted it to be this way. It's been programmed like this by the U.S. It's because they want to install fear in American citizens everywhere, so they can also justify invasions to Muslim countries and to, invade different Muslim countries.
The Supreme Court is expected to issue its ruling on the Muslims case by the end of June. Lawyers for the government will argue that the case should be dismissed, as letting it proceed would expose clandestine intelligence operations and harm national security. The FBI has long contended that the information about its informants, methods of surveillance, and who they are monitoring and why should be treated as state secrets. Human rights activists, however, say citing national security concerns is an excuse to avoid admitting that they target people based on their religion. The plaintiffs argue that under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, known as FISA, a judge can review the material and order that it be disclosed. They contend that in a case like theirs, the 1978 law supersedes the state secrets privilege, which was adopted by the Supreme Court in the 1950s. Government lawyers' counter-argument is that FISA was not meant for a case where the government certifies that the disclosure would jeopardize national security. All eyes are on the Supreme Court justices, whose ruling will indicate whether they are willing to protect religious freedoms or if the government has the authority to cover up its illegal activities in the name of national security.
Start.
Movement.
Speak.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamadi.
Islamadi.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Time.
Assalamu alaikum. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Youth Station Choo Choo Kachoo. It's the youth station for you. I'm your host, Muzaffar Haider. Here in the studio today, we have with us a very special guest who I don't know. I don't actually know you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. My name is Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi, and I am a talaba, as you guys call it, student of the Hawza here in Qom. I've been here for a while, specialized in Hadith and Quran. I'm from Australia, as you can tell from my accent.
Yeah, yeah, I can tell from your accent. You're an Aussie. You're an Aussie. Yeah. That place is crazy.
You can say that.
Australia is insane. You can say that. The other day I saw a photograph of two snakes wrestling each other to death while a dog ate the head of a shark at the shore of a beach.
Yeah, well.
And the caption read, "This is Australia."
It is, indeed. Yeah, we have a lot of weird things.
Here in Iran, there's no creepy crawlies, which I'm really thankful for.
Me too. I hate snakes.
Oh, you hate snakes?
I hate anything that creeps.
Did you ever have any experiences with snakes back home?
When I was a kid, I did. I had a few encounters, but that still gives me a trauma until today.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm very scared of snakes.
All right, so how long have you been here? It's really good to meet you.
You too, bro.
All right, well, that's actually a really cool point. That can lead us into another question that I had for you, which is about learning from the past.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So if you've been bitten by a snake, you know, once bitten, twice shy, you learn from it, right?
Sure.
Did you get bitten, by the way?
I've never had a chance of being bitten, but once I was walking by the riverside, me and my friends were coming back from school, and somehow the poison of the snake fell on my leg, on my jeans. And I swear I could feel the pain in my leg. And, like, that pain stayed for a while. So it must have been, like, a deadly poisonous snake. And so it kept me, like...
Wait, you didn't have any wounds on your leg?
No.
Like, it just went through your skin?
I could feel that, like, the pain just managed to go... Like, the wetness of the poison managed to, like, have contact with my skin. And, like, it kept me in pain for a while. Like, for a few days. Yeah, it was, I'm just feeling the pain in my... So I'm like, okay, me and the snake, now go. So when it comes to learning from the past, definitely you have to learn. Otherwise, what's the point?
What's the point of life, really?
Yeah, even Allah says in the Quran, "Siru fil ardi fanduru." You know, walk on the ground and land and see the nations before
Travel,
you learn.
Have a look, see what I've created.
If you don't learn from the past, then pretty much you're not going to learn anything.
But you know what's scarier than snakes, right?
What?
People.
People? I don't want to generalize. You have good mu'mineen, you have good people. Obviously, there are bad people. There are good snakes and bad snakes, I guess. Yeah, poisonous and non-poisonous. So with people, if it's mu'min, you get to learn from them too. If it's non-mu'min, obviously you get to learn from them too.
Mm-hmm.
So either way, you end up learning. It's got to be positive, though. A lot of people are negative towards people. I'm not a negative type either.
Like, what do you mean negative?
Like, you've seen a lot of people, like, they're constantly journalizing, like, oh, I hate people, I hate this, you know. Constantly, like, you know, giving people, like, just a bad name, a negative. And I'm like, dude, they are good people. You know,
they're
good,
good people.
They're good people, good-hearted. Maybe you haven't had a chance to meet a good one. Maybe your life, you're, you know, constantly meeting the wrong ones.
I think
maybe that's a way from Allah trying to get you to learn from the people, you know, from the past.
That actually, you've just described me. Something I get into that mode when I'm just like, people are just they're just horrible.
Yeah, we do. I guess we do. We all do. But I don't know. Like when I was young, I had this image as well. People are all evil, and then I thought, well, so what? That makes me I'm the only good one.